Here again, we have this exclusive position with great stress on the social group to which you belong and the privilege, you might say, of that identification. So I would say, instead of religion of identification with the divinity, you have here a religion of achievement of a relationship to the divinity through identification with his group. And now look what has happened. The claims of this tradition to special divine authority have been called into question by science and historical scholarship. There's no doubt about it. The problem of most Western minds today is this. Having been deprived of the sense of divinity in themselves by the church, they now have been deprived of the sense of the claim of the church by science. And so we have what is called alienation. And this quest now for roots again, I think, is the main quest of which I, at any rate, have become aware of in my viewing of students and adults and just lost people. So much then for the four great domains. I haven't named the fourth really, namely Europe. Here we have brought now into Europe the Levantine tradition. In Europe we have faith in the human being. Consider, for instance, the main position of the Levant. When we have two terms, God and man, there comes the final question as to your ultimate loyalty. Is it going to be to God or is it going to be to man? Is it going to be to the mystery of God or to the ideas and ideals of man? Now for the Oriental, this conflict, look at us. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, we are with Prometheus. And Sunday for a couple of minutes with Job. And the next Monday on the psychiatrist's couch, wondering what's the matter. These are two absolutely irreconcilable, absolutely contrary points of view that we pretend to have brought together, and we haven't resolved this. The European races, with their individualism and humanism, Greek, Roman, Celt, and German, had this system brought in upon them. And if you study the history of Christianity in Europe, its outstanding characteristic is heresy. Battles against heresy, fight against heresy, this way and that, and finally heresy won. With Protestantism, the individual conscience was to be the judge, not a social authority that tells you what you are to believe. Now, it's my view that in this present world, at this present minute, we are facing the hour of decision. Man against the authority of a group that claims divine authority. And we have plenty of those groups, and they're all getting together, cozy, here and there. It just seems to me this decision has to be recognized and confronted. So much then for the four points of view. Of course, in the Orient, this conflict between God and man would be regarded as ridiculous, since they are both, they represent simply two aspects, two ways, two modes of manifestation of that one which is the one in all of us. It's cosmic manifestation and it's human manifestation, with the cosmic values and the human values in apparent conflict but ultimate accord, somehow, somewhere, beyond the pairs of opposites. So much then for this phase of my review. First, the four functions of mythology, and then the four domains in which the inflections, local inflections of the mystery of being have been rendered. I want now to speak about that aspect of the mythological heritage which is constant, namely that which depends upon the human psyche, the human being in his growth and a life. In relation to psychology, the function of mythology and ritual is to carry the individual over the threshold of his growth, flowering, and decline. The human being has the longest infancy of any animal in the world. It's 12 years at least before the individual is able to take care of himself at all, and the maturity of the physique is not reached until the early 20s. Meanwhile, an attitude, a psychological attitude of dependency, has been established. The individual responds to threats and so forth with a turn for assistance or protection or advice to the parent. This attitude of dependency, then, has, at a certain moment, somewhere in early or late puberty, to be transformed into an attitude of self-responsible conduct, responsibility. All of the reactions of the psyche, which originally were of a dependent order, have to be transformed into reactions of responsibility. A neurotic might be said to be one who, in later age, is spontaneously reacting still in the way of dependency and has to correct himself and say, look, act your age, and then you have this correction of his spontaneous response. The person who has effectively crossed the threshold is one who immediately assumes the responsibilities of his time and place. Now, the first function, then, of the myths in relation to the development of the individual is to affect that transition from dependency to responsibility, and in the primitive cultures this is affected in the initiation rites. In these rites, the whole psychology of the youth is transformed. He is himself brought into the position of the father by a ritual death of the infantile personality and resurrection then of the adult through rites of terrible emotional stress and power. The basic images to which he is to respond are transformed in their sense for him. And I would say that in our present culture world, the function of the Freudian psychology has been largely that. I think we can say that Freud's function has been to help people pass from the psychological posture of childhood to that of maturity. But then there comes another time. The human being is the animal that has the longest period of old age, the longest period of increasing senility and loss of powers, and is the only animal that, facing this, knows that he personally is to die. This is the only animal that has to face death consciously and face it over many, many years with increasing weight. The myths have to help us over that threshold too, the threshold of the loss of powers. You might say, no sooner have we learned what the society wants us to do, then they found a younger generation ready to do it, and you're beginning to lose not only your competence, but your job. Just when you're good, you're out. So this is a little crisis as well. Now, all societies have had to face this. The age classes are the most constant phenomenon in primitive societies, the childhood group, the mature group, and the aged group. They help the aged along by making them think they're the wise ones, you know, in the old societies, and we don't even have that advantage. So I would say that the psychologist who in our world dealt most successfully with this second problem has been Jung. This is, in fact, the concern of Jung. Now, there are papers that Freud wrote to the profession, to young psychiatrists, in which he states, don't even bother with anybody over the age of 35. There's just too much to do, too much to take apart, and there's nothing left. There's no energy to put back together again the pieces that you've left around. Whereas that's exactly where Jung becomes interested. And the contrast in the two psychologies stems from the totally contrary problems that are faced when we're dealing with a young person who hasn't grown up yet and dealing with an older person who has to face this loss of security that comes. What it is that certain functions of the psyche have been left undeveloped. How do those functions come into play? The most obvious way to bring them into play is the old way that would have been all right 30 years ago, but that's not the way to bring them in play now. And so this problem of integrating the psyche in terms that are appropriate to its stage of life and all is the great problem, as Jung says, of culture, of civilization in the last half of life. Now, in connection with this, since I've been talking about Orient and Occident, let me very briefly summarize first the Oriental and then a very handsome Occidental view of the four stages of life. To begin with, let me describe the Indian view. The main principle in India is that in the middle of life, there's to be a radical change and division that is provided for by the society and by the patterns of the society. The first half of life is to be lived in the village, in society, performing the duties of one's caste. The second half of life is to be lived in the forest, performing yoga. Casting off the duties of life, casting off the aims of life in society, and devoting oneself to totally different life circumstances, totally different life disciplines, to the ultimate task, which is a different ultimate task from ours, by the way. Now, each of these two stages of life is divided in half, the first half of each being devoted to learning, to the disciplines of preparation, and the second half to fulfillment. Now, the orthodox age dates are 15 years. This is 15 years, 30 years, 45, and out. The Indians had a shorter lifespan to look forward to normally than we have. The first stage is that of the student. The student is to be chaste, is to devote all of his attention and energy to the guru, the teacher. The word guru means something very different from what teacher means in our culture. The guru is not only a communicator of information and teacher of disciplines, he is a model for life. He is a moral model. The student is to try to imitate him, to identify with him, to be as the guru is. The student then submits himself completely to his guru. Then at the age of 15 or so comes the stage known as the householder stage, grihastha, the one standing in the house. The marriage is consummated. Now, here, these two people have never seen each other before. There's been nothing like what our young people have, this problem of what am I going to be, what are my values, what do I think of that, what is my idea of a wife or a husband. No, the family makes the arrangement. They've never seen each other before. It doesn't matter. Now, the first duty of the household is to produce children. This is in honor of the ancestral cult. And so, by the time the father reaches middle age, 30-ish or so, there is a son in the house eligible to take over the duties of his dharma. He gives over his dharma, his virtue, his duty to his son in a beautiful rite. All of the rites, by the way, are beautiful. Marriage rites, transferring of duty rites. What one does is identify oneself with the cosmic principle of which one is but the microcosmic manifestation. And so you're living, as it were, as a vehicle of cosmic power. Well, now comes the time of going to the forest. Woman may go to the forest. The father properly should go to the forest. I've asked Indian women, what do you have to look forward to? In your childhood, you're obeying your parents, and your maturity, you're obeying your husband. If your husband dies and you don't throw yourself on the funeral pyre, you're obeying your oldest son. What do you have to look forward to? They've all answered, I've asked four of them this, we look forward to becoming mothers-in-law. When the daughter-in-law is brought into the house, there's somebody we can boss around. This will give you a sense of the flavor, and who would give that up for the forest? So the father goes off alone. Furthermore, it is said in many texts that women are not particularly endowed for yoga. They have too much life in their body. Yoga is a masculine madness. It is an attempt to cut out the last vestige of a desire or feeling for life at all, just to cut it. The extreme aims of yoga are hardly realized by people who, in a dilettante way, go in for this business. Just think of it. Throughout life, you have obeyed your duties according to your caste. That is what you have devoted yourself to. You have not asked, would I like to do this, would I like to do that? You have done your duty. That means there has been no development of ego. There has been a squelching of ego all along. Then you go to the forest. You have a very light ego to crack, so to say. What has to be done there? You might recall that moment was lovely. This moment I did not like. You're now to erase all sense of difference between what was nice and what was not nice, what is painful and what is pleasurable. That's why these mad ordeals, so that you would become used to pain, so that you become used to agony, so that it wouldn't make any difference to you, so that your life milieu would be agony. And so then, what of pleasure? What that would be simply a loss of the thing you've now got used to, namely pain, the indifference, and finally the breaking, so to say, of the very grabbing of the cells to life, and you dissolve. The third stage, then, the first in the forest, is that of learning to break the hold on life, and the fourth stage is that of the one who has broken it. He is what is called released. Shankaracharya, the great saint of the 9th century, declares that a man who is released is like a burnt string. That looks like a string, but if you blow on it, there's nothing there. These saints wandering around look like human beings, but there's nobody there. There's no sense of an individual in that body. When he goes into the forest, he gives up his virtue. He gives up his dharma. He gives up his family and everything. And now he's going to just wait for the body, as they say, to drop off. This is the basic Oriental idea. Now, in contrast to that, let me conclude by reviewing the four ages as described by Dante in that wonderful work of his, the Convito. This is in the last chapters of the Convito of Dante. He says, life falls into four stages. So I thought, oh, great. Now, he was 35 in the year 1300. His dates are 1265 to 1321. It was a theory in the Middle Ages. The 1300 was the middle year of the world. The world had been created somewhere 4000 or so B.C., and we're in the middle year now. So Dante, the middle year of Dante's life, he took 35 as the mid-year of life, fell in the mid-year of the world's life, and he had his descent to hell, purgatory, and ascent to heaven on the Good Friday to Easter weekend of that fabulous year. So he united his individual curve with the cosmic curve and all that kind of thing. We have a straight line through. He says, life divides at 35. Now, the first half, the first quarter of life, he gives 25 years to that. the first 25 years of life, he calls the period of increase and adolescence, that of growing up and increase. And the virtues of those years, they sound rather strange in relation to what we've been seeing lately. They are obedience, sense of shame, grace, and beauty. Those are the virtues of youth, the year 1300. The middle period, maturity, stretches from 25 to 45, with 35 as the midpoint. These are the years of fulfillment of your role in society, as society understands them. The virtues are reason, courage, love, and loyalty, and courteousness. But at the 35 age, a crisis occurs. This is the crisis symbolized in Dante's Divine Comedy, of individual realization of those truths which were suggested by the tradition in which you were brought up. Let's say you just don't accept tradition. Tradition leads you to a moment of your own personal realization of truth in the mystery of being. We come then to the period which he calls of age, from 45 to 70. This is not a period of retirement to the forest. This is not a period of self-erasure. In the course of your 20 years of maturity, you have come to your own judgments, your own realizations, your own evaluations, and now you put them into effect in the world. This is the age for the senators, for the governors, for participation in the government, or for teaching. This is the age of giving. First was growth, next was maturity and fulfillment of your role, and now is the age of giving, of your wisdom, your own wisdom, not repeating traditional wisdom. And the virtues now are prudence and wisdom, magnanimity, generosity. It's generally one of giving, unloading, giving your treasure to the world. And then from 70 onward, this is the period that he calls the period of departure. And it is typified as follows. Looking backward over the span of your life with gratitude, and looking forward to death as a return home. There's that sense of appreciation of the void and the abyss, and yet of appreciation for life. You leave life in a nice balance, not resenting your departure, nor resenting what life did to you. Now, to conclude this little survey, this little contrast of Oriental and Occidental aims here, I think you can see something of the Jungian thing in this Dantean picture, in contrast to the Indian. Let me just repeat, some of you must know this, the three ages that Nietzsche names in the Thus Begs Zarathustra. These are vivid, and they fit this very well. The first age of man and of the spirit he calls the age of the camel. The camel gets down on his knees and says, "Put a big heavy load on me so that I'll have something really to carry. I'll have a job to do." And when the camel has been thoroughly loaded with duties and jobs and lessons and teachings and so forth, it gets to its feet and it trots out into the desert, where it becomes a lion. The lion is the second transformation of the spirit. And this lion attacks and kills the dragon, whose name is Thou Shalt. The dragon Thou Shalt has 1,000 golden scales, and on every scale is written a law, some of these laws going back to 3000 BC. The lion kills the dragon. There are no Thou Shalts anymore. This is the battle of the middle of life, that 35-year-old one that I spoke about. And from then on, when this has been achieved, the lion is transformed into a child. Spontaneity of its own inner life is its directing power, and it is comparable to a wheel rolling out of its own center, not pulled by a string, but with the motive power in its own hub rolling. Ein aus sich rollendes Rad, a wheel rolling out of its own center, says Nietzsche. These are the three transformations. And again, the free spirit is the one who has achieved freedom. But first, and this is the big point in all of these men, the first age is that of learning something and working and giving to giving your energies and time to what you are taught to do. So there we are. That's the first hour here. And I thought if I would ask for questions.
You've been listening to Thresholds of Mythology, the first talk by Joseph Campbell in the series entitled Inward Journey, East and West. This recording was authorized by the Joseph Campbell Foundation and produced by Electronic Educational Programs. Our theme music is by Acoustic Alchemy. For more information on the work of Joseph Campbell, please call the Foundation at 1-800-330-MYTH, 1-800-330-MYTH, or you can contact us on the World Wide Web at jcf.org. I'm Maura Vaughan. Thank you for listening.